You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. until 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Clap your hands.
Good morning, listeners. You are tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 on your AM dial. It is Thursday, the 23rd of April, and it's a bit of a chilly morning today, although I feel like every week that we have a little bit of sun, I'm like, this is going to be the last week until summer next year. So it is going to hit 26 today. I encourage people to get out there if you can, at the very least on your lunch break if you're working. But it has been nice to have a little break from the freezing temperatures of last week. I've optimistically been wearing shorts all week, even though that means a bit of suffering early in the morning when I'm riding into radio. Have people noticed that the number 11 trams, some of them have ads for weight loss with BMI notifications on them? I thought that we got rid of these ideas around BMI being actually representative of anything real and being a broadly generalizable measure of health in like the 2010s. But no, apparently that's still a thing. So, you know, the show must go on. We have a packed program for you today. And we're going to start up by listening to some excerpts from the Wednesday, 8th April edition of 3CR's Raising Our Voices program, which is a long-running self-advocacy radio show by people with disability for people with disability. And in this segment, the team are sharing their experiences with direct and indirect discrimination, and they talk about ways to stop it from happening. After that, we will be listening to an interview that Inez did with Hadissa, now that's an alias, about Save Community Health, a campaign to save the Collingwood and Fitzroy co-health centres. Now, Hadissa is a Save Community Health member and caught up with Inez this week about the really important role that co-health has played in her life for the past 10 years as a refugee from Afghanistan. They're going to go through a submission that Hadissa made to the government-funded review of co-health looking at the proposed closures. And after that, we will be joined by Tom Cooper, who's a public housing resident, organizer, and member of the group 44 Flats United, for a conversation about the state government's attack on the older person's public housing towers, concerns about displacement, the value of community, and the fight back. And really excited to have Tom in studio to talk about an important organizing win in the St. Kilda public housing organizing space. After that, to continue the conversation about co-health, Sade, who's a doctor and organizer, is speaking with us again to talk about the Save Co-Health campaign updates. And this includes an upcoming rally demanding the urgent release of the findings of the government-funded review of co-health, which is happening this Sunday, the 26th of April at 12 p.m. at Co-Health Collingwood. So that's 365 Huddle Street, Collingwood. And finally, we are joined in studio by disability advocate Andrew Bretherton to unpack this week's announcements about the Albanese government's planned cuts to the NDIS in the May budget, as well as the relationships between austerity, disability, and inadequate recognition for people with ME/CFS. So remember, stay tuned all the way through until 8:30 in the morning, and stay tuned all day. Why change your radio dial? Honestly, you're not going to find much better than 3CR 855 AM. We'll be back to you shortly with the news headlines for today.
Tune in to Stick Together, all about workers' rights and social justice.
8:30 a.m. Wednesday, 7 a.m. Saturday.
Or listen on demand on 3CR's website, 3cr.org.au.
It is Thursday, the 23rd of April, and these are your news headlines for today. Israel's ongoing occupation of southern Lebanon during the supposed ceasefire is being denounced as a continuation of its military aggression, entrenching illegal Israeli control over Lebanese land and imposing a new reality for people in the occupied area by force. Despite the so-called ceasefire, Israeli forces continue airstrikes and the large-scale destruction of villages and infrastructure as part of what they refer to as a forward defense zone, fueling fears that mass displacement will lead to a prolonged occupation of the south. The occupation also pushes into coastal areas overlapping with parts of Lebanon's maritime zone, believed to contain gas fields, which analysts say demonstrates Israel's intentions to seize natural resources alongside territory. In other news this week, Israeli settlers shot dead two Palestinians in the West Bank, including a 14-year-old student, during an attack on a school near Ramallah that also wounded at least four Palestinians. Witnesses reported settlers dressed in clothes similar to Israeli Defense Force uniforms, directing gunfire at students and residents. The incident is part of an ongoing severe escalation of settler violence, often accompanied and sanctioned by the Israeli Defense Force across the occupied West Bank. Also in headlines, a fire at the Viva Energy refinery in Jelang last week that was caused by a gas leak and burned for 13 hours has been described by the United Firefighters Union Victoria as, quote, not expected and potentially catastrophic, end quote. The union blamed aging infrastructure and alleged safety shortcomings, noting the 1950s-era facility operates at full capacity and has faced long-standing maintenance concerns. While no serious injuries were reported in relation to the fire, the incident has raised alarm about fuel supply impacts, community safety, and the Australian government's reliance on fossil fuels and aging energy infrastructure. Also in news this week, Wurundjeri Woiwurrung traditional owners have formally entered the Treaty Authority's negotiations register, signalling their intention to begin treaty talks with the Victorian government. Some First Nations community leaders say a future treaty would support self-determination and efforts to improve outcomes such as life expectancy, mental health, and the restoration of cultural and ecological practices across their country. In other news, Digital Rights Watch has welcomed the Albanese government's response to the review of the Online Safety Act 2021, particularly the proposed introduction of a digital duty of care that would require technology companies to take greater responsibility for user safety. Digital rights experts say the reform could significantly improve online experiences if implemented well, but warned its success will depend on transparent, rights-respecting enforcement to avoid censorship and increased marginalisation. And finally in headlines this week, residents of Papunya in Pintupi Lurcha land in the Western Desert region have launched a landmark federal court case against the Northern Territory government, alleging it has failed to provide public housing that is safe during extreme heat. The residents say decades of neglect have left homes without adequate insulation, shading or cooling, with conditions becoming unlivable as temperatures regularly exceed 40 degrees Celsius. If successful, the case could force improvements to housing standards in remote communities and set a precedent for climate-safe public housing across so-called Australia. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 23rd of April, and you're listening to 3CR on 855 AM. Now, just before we leave you with those headlines, I did want to mention an event that is coming up today, a bit of a self-indulgent plug because I'm involved in supporting this event and facilitating, but it is going to be an incredible discussion with Dr. Amy McQuire and Martin Hodgson, a conversation about race, missing persons, policing, and the courts in Australia, held by the Centre Against Racial Profiling. It's called Young, Black, Missing, and it's held online today from 1 to 2 p.m. AEST. Now, To find out more information, to get a last-minute ticket, you can head to the Centre Against Racial Profiling's Instagram, and that's just Centre Against Racial Profiling on Instagram. And this is a fundraiser for the Justice for Amabile campaign, where we are supporting the family and loved ones of Amabile Manirakiza, who is a young person who went missing and, you know, whose missingness caused a massive community search, but whose missingness and untimely death at a very, very young age has caused ripples throughout the community. This event intends to shine a spotlight on that intersection between blackness, youth, and the carceral system, and the way that there is an unequal valuation of life that does lead to these tragic outcomes for young black folks who go missing in so-called Australia. So again, that is Young Black Missing. You can find information at the Centre Against Racial Profiling's Instagram, and it's from 1 to 2pm online today. And tickets are free for mob, Afro-diaspora, and families of missing persons.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. 3CR is determined to stay independent. This means we don't rely on corporate sponsorship or government funding. We serve our community, not corporate interests. But this also means we do rely on people like you to keep the station running. From paying the bills to maintaining our studios to training the next generation of community broadcasters, 3CR relies on community donations to survive. By becoming a regular donor, you can help us stay resilient and radical. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
Well, if you're not convinced by that, I don't know what's going to do it. You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and we are heading into our first segment for today, where we listen to some excerpts from the Wednesday, 8th April edition of 3CR's Raising Our Voices program, a long-running self-advocacy radio show by people with disability for people with disability. And in this little clip, the team are sharing their experiences with direct and indirect discrimination and ways to stop it from happening. You can listen back to that full episode and find out more by heading to 3cr.org.au/raisingourvoices. And don't forget to tune in to Raising Our Voices live on the first Wednesday of every month from 6 to 6:30pm on 3CR 855am.
Some of the examples that we've been talking about are what's called direct discrimination. So an employer refusing to give you a job because you have a disability, that's direct discrimination. An Uber or taxi driver refusing to pick you up because you have a guide dog, that's direct discrimination. There's also something called indirect discrimination, when there's a rule that's applied to everybody, but some people are much less able to follow the rule than others. For example, it could be indirect discrimination if you insist that people have to have a driver's license to get a job. It could be indirect discrimination if you have to do an application in writing and there's no way to negotiate a different way of doing it. Could be indirect discrimination if you have to start work at 8 o'clock in the morning.
I've got an example, mate. Many years ago, I was asked for driver's license. I'm visually impaired. People with visual impairment don't have a driver's license or ID, and I took them to the local discrimination board and they accepted stuff like that. So through me taking them to the local board or something like that, when they made arrangements for me to go another way, That is a small victory on my behalf. And that's turning back the hands of time too, you guys.
It hasn't changed much, Amanda. There are still plenty of places that ask for people to have a driver's license when what they really need is somebody that can get to places.
Right now, have an age card and it's non-expirable. It's non-expirable. I use it for the banks and stuff like that, and they don't give me any trouble anymore. I get to self-advocacy. Hand out and stand up for myself.
Yeah, there's lots of discrimination. The people picking on you and calling you names, like weird names. As an example, taxis refusing short trips.
That's illegal, I think.
It is illegal, yes.
That's a good
name. Like getting picked on and swore out in the public, it's happened a lot of times to me.
That's no good.
Is that when you buy yourself or you got your support worker with you?
It's happened to me when I've been with a friend or someone else or by myself. It's happened a lot of times. And but if issues like that go on, I do have some people that I trust to tell, and that's my sisters. Or my brother-in-laws, they don't want anything like that happening to me. And when that happens and I call them, I tell them what has happened, and they will come down the street straight away and they'll tell those people off.
Yeah, that's good.
That's what my sisters do. Yeah, I have four younger sisters that help me a lot.
Yep. Would you like to share with us when you were discriminated against?
Yeah.
Go.
Okay. One time, I don't remember when it was, but I think it was sometime last year. Yeah, it was sometime last year. I was actually on the side of the road I had just finished gymnastics training, and then I was on the side of the road of the bus stop that heads toward East Bendigo, and I was doing loops all the time to get into town. The bus driver said to me, "Are you going into town?" And I went, "Yes." And then the bus driver said, "Go on the other side. I'll be back in it in 15 minutes.
Oh, yuck.
Yeah, and I was upset that day.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, and the bus driver discriminated me from getting on the bus.
That's not good.
No, that's right.
Yep. Some buses don't have this ramp, so if any in a wheelchair can't get on it, so you can go with a wide cane and all the other stuff too. And some people can't get on buses because they don't have the right equipment, so you can get on safely. The driver will let you on because it's got a full bus, but people are not using their manners today, and it's horrible. They should think of other people with disabilities than themselves. I'm sorry, it doesn't happen that way sometimes, and it is disgusting.
Yeah. That's not good.
I was discriminated against because of my disability, because I use a walker 24/7, and I was trying to get on a tram, and there were people standing where the walkers go, and I asked them to move, but they wouldn't move. And I spoke up when I got on the tram, and they wouldn't move.
That's disgusting.
Yeah, it is disgusting, but I've also been picked on at school about my disability. Yeah, so that was hard for me anyway.
I'm sorry to hear that too, James.
That's all right.
It's terrible.
It is terrible, yes.
We could have got one more topic. There are some of the old trams on my line number one, East Melbourne tram. They've still got the old tram with the steps. I've got to get up slowly and I've got to get off the tram slowly. And I have a white cane. For goodness sake, put the low floor trams on my line. I don't know if it meets the other with walkers, pushers. We need the new low floor on my line.
Mm. And another thing, some people don't even believe that I'm actually very afraid of walking downstairs because I have, when I've been to one of my programs, one of my group programs, one time I got told to walk downstairs and I wanted to go down the ramp, and I'm very afraid of walking downstairs because of what happened to me. In 2017, I fell down the stairs and fell onto the tactiles and cut my head and had to go to hospital and have 6 stitches in my head. And I'm scared of stairs that are very steep.
Oh, join the club.
Can I say, sometimes it's difficult to know if you're being discriminated against or not, particularly if it's something like a job interview or you're trying to get a rental property or whatever, because you might suspect that you're being treated less favourably because of your disability or your age or the colour of your skin or whatever it is. Employers and real estate agents often aren't silly enough to actually say it aloud, which makes it very difficult to put in a complaint. You can only put in a complaint if they're silly enough to say to your face that that's why you didn't get the job or you didn't get the property or whatever. And mostly they're not. You might suspect it, particularly when you hear, I've heard of people going for a job and then being told, sorry, we've already given the job to somebody else, but then you hear that's not true.
Lying.
Yeah, they'll even lie to you rather than flat out say, we are not going to give you this job because you've got a disability and we don't think you can do it.
My opinion, the world is too cruel for people with disabilities. They should give poor people, it doesn't matter if they've got a white cane or a walker or whatever, they should be allowed to have a go or a chance to do the job to see if they can do it or not. But sorry, that does not happen in this crazy world.
What can people do if they are discriminated against?
Write it down and write the place where you got discriminated against. Write down some details of the person that discriminated against you.
And then you find a legal service that, you know, to mention, I can mention two off the cuff. There's Philomander Disability Legal Service done in Geelong and Disability Rights Legal Service, Ross House on the second floor. They are good people and they won't leave you hanging because I've used them both.
Speak up about it. And you can tell, like, anyone you trust if you get discriminated, like telling a family member or a close friend.
You can make a complaint. And most disability discrimination is actually against the law.
Yeah, yep, yep.
Who can help you make a complaint if you were discriminated against?
There's a state thing. You can go to the state office. I don't know what it's called now, but my time a number of years ago with the Equal Opportunities Commission, apparently, so that state law and the federal law is the DDA Act, which is a Disability Discrimination Act, and that's federal law.
You can get help from a friend or a family member.
Yep, yep.
Can get help from an advocate.
Yes.
Or you can get help from a community legal service. There are community legal services that specialise in disability issues, like Philomanta Legal Service or Disability DDLS.
Dallas.
Yeah. But most community legal services would be able to help or at least give you some advice.
Where can people make a complaint about disability discrimination?
Websites.
The Australian Human Rights Commission or the Victorian Opportunities Commission. So date in Australia, there's a disability legal service for in Ross House. Yep. And to these places, if you are discriminated against.
Sometimes you can make a complaint to the place you discriminated against. Or, for example, if you were discriminated against by a taxi driver or an Uber driver,
you
would go to the head office and make a complaint there. So not necessarily directly to the person that did the discrimination, but to their boss or their management.
Do you think that'd be a good starting place to get your evidence and all that stuff, or at least try to get some evidence to back you up type of stuff?
Where it's an individual that's discriminating, the policy of the organisation is okay. For example, the taxi directorate says that drivers can't discriminate against people with guide dogs. But drivers are discriminating against people with guide dogs. Maybe in that sort of case, you could take down the driver's number and then report them to the taxi directorate. Because the taxi directorate will think that the driver has done the wrong thing. Where it gets difficult is when an organisation has a policy, written or unwritten, that's discriminatory.
You notice in taxis these days, or in the door, and there is a sticker on the door. You can put your iPhone over the thing. I mean, complaint to that way type of thing. This is on the cab driver's door or all doors in the cab. It's a QR code and it's stickers on the taxi driver's doors. So pay attention the next time you get in the cab, make sure you find this stuff on the doors of the cab.
You're tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And that was a segment from the Wednesday, 8th April edition of 3CR's Raising Our Voices program, which is a long-running self-advocacy radio show by people with disability for people with disability. And here the team shared their experiences about direct and indirect discrimination, as well as ways to stop it from happening and how to report it if it does happen to you. And you can listen back to that full episode and find out more by heading to 3cr.org.au/raising our voices. And shout out to our wonderful current affairs coordinator, Karina, who showed me a lovely picture of Amanda Miller from Raising Our Voices from 1987. That show has been going for 49 years and it is supported by AMIDA, Action for More Independence and Dignity in Accommodation. And you can tune into Raising Our Voices live on the first Wednesday of every month from 6 to 6:30 p.m. on 3CR 855 AM.
Friday, May 1st is May Day, International Workers' Day. Join 3CR all day in our 50th year of coverage in solidarity with the continued struggle for labour rights and fair working conditions for all our communities around the world.
We got May Day specials from regular Friday shows and special presentations from 3CR's programmers from across the grid. For more info, head to www.3cr.org.au/May Day 2026.
Friday, May the 1st.
Tune in all day right here on 3CR.
You're tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 7:30 in the morning. And now we are listening to an interview that Inez conducted this week with Hadissa, now that's an alias, who is a member of Save Community Health. And Hadissa was speaking with Inez about the vital role CoHealth Collingwood and Fitzroy have played in her life for the past 10 years as a refugee from Afghanistan. Hadissa also made a submission to the government-funded review of CoHealth, looking at the proposed CoHealth closures. So in this interview, they go through Hadissa's submission and the Save Community Health campaign group. Now, to contact or join Save Community Health, you can email savecommunityhealth@gmail.com. And remember to stay tuned for our interview with Sade, who is a doctor and organizer, about the CoHealth review and rally this Sunday. But for now, let's listen to that interview that Inez conducted with Hadissa.
Welcome to 3CR Thursday Breakfast. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for asking.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could tell us, our listeners, a little bit more about yourself.
I came from Afghanistan as a refugee, and at the moment I'm a representative of Farsi-speaking refugees in the area of Collingwood and what do you call it?
City of Melbourne?
City of Melbourne.
Yes. Yeah, wonderful. Thank you so much for, yeah, coming on today to talk about such an important issue.
Thank you.
When it comes to CoHealth and community health, as also as a refugee and a person living here, how has community health and CoHealth helped you?
Actually, I receive supports or services from CoHealth, Collingwood and Fitzroy the past 10 years. It's excellent. We have used to have female doctors, nurses, counselors, pharmacy, physiotherapists, and more. We received support from.
What has the service been like at CoHealth when you really needed help over the last 10 years?
Really, they provide excellent services, but sometimes we had problem with the getting a doctor, that's long waiting list appointment with the doctors, and the rest was okay, excellent.
It's such a important community service that is low cost and free and can do prevention rather than having to just go to the emergency room when things are really bad. How have you felt about the recent CoHealth cut news?
Okay, about the cut and means close some branches.
Yeah. And the GP services and mental health and pharmacy.
Yeah, definitely. Not only me, my group, most of the people who use the services, they feel very disappointed.
And when you say they feel disappointed, what do you think they're disappointed by?
As a refugee, I have my own telling about my experience, which is, first of all, the language is a barrier for most of refugees when they come to Australia. If they want to find another services, it will be hard for them to understand. Not only the languages, is also the financial problem, as well as technology. Understanding the technology, familiarity with the system, in different aspects, it will affect negatively the refugees.
And if you maybe were to, as refugees, go to like the emergency room or different services, what is that experience like? Like, you probably have to find maybe a translator, find the money, find the Medicare.
Definitely, yes. Money is the first issue. Second, the language to understand, and it's a long wait list. Not only one issue, it's a few issues.
And I know that the CEO, the chief executive in our interview last week, said a lot about the importance of listening to community members and striving for like more inclusive spaces. And that can be a lot of talk, and given how CoHealth proposed these cuts and didn't come to the town hall meeting last year, I'm wondering what you think inclusive spaces look like, and if you have any questions for CoHealth and their leaders.
Actually, I did hear Nicole's interview, but I would like to say it is mostly exclusive instead of inclusive. Why I'm saying that, I'm not agree with that, because if they cut, if they close down the branches, so who will suffer? Poor people like refugees, homeless people, they're going to exclude it from the support which they have received. So, don't know.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I know you're doing really great. I think it's really important to talk about this from the people that use the service and need the services and know what it's like. And, you know, as you said, you in CoHealth, you probably are using a lot of the different services that they have. What kind of services do you and the community use at CoHealth, and why are they so important that you can't get anywhere else?
Of course, we could get somewhere else, but as I told you, the financial problem, the language barrier, the familiar with the technology, familiar with the system, this is for a refugee who comes here as an adult. It's not easy to cope with all of these things.
I guess what has it been like with other health or social services compared to CoHealth?
For example, I lived somewhere before 10 years ago. We didn't have the... I met the doctors, but they didn't have the female doctor. When I moved in here and I find the female doctor plus the counselor plus the podiatrist or physio, that things really... I was very happy. It means I'm happy at the moment that I received that. But when they heard that they're going to close down the branches, then really are disappointed. So somewhere else, as I thought, if you receive one service or support, the other, they don't have might. You have to go around the city and find somewhere else. It's make a kind of complicated problem, difficult for refugees to cope with,
Yeah. Do you think it's good when in CoHealth they have everything kind of in one spot?
Yes, it is excellent. Yes, of course.
Because now what are people going to do? You have to, as you said, they have to find services, each single service in different places. Yes. You're not sure with the financial cost or the languages, and not having it all in one place, I'm sure, is
really
hard.
Right. But in CoHealth we had everything there, lots of services, and they provide.
Yeah. And compared to, like, when something is really wrong with health and it's immediate and you will need to go to the emergency room, how is that different to, yeah, getting, like, long-term care? Like, you're going counselling, you're going to the podiatrist, you're, you have the GP and the counselling versus just having to go to the emergency room.
Of course, the emergency room, they might not have this kind of services, all of the services, but might have one service or two. That is why I'm saying that is whatever we receive support from the cohort is excellent. And yeah.
Yeah, thank you. What would you like to happen now with co-health and community health and, yeah, save community health?
Actually, first of all, on behalf of refugees, I wanted to express my appreciation for the Australian government humane policies and support for refugees. And what I want to happen, instead of they closing down the branches and they close down the support and services for these vulnerable people, they could put more services, like a counselor or the doctors, more services to people use it and enjoy for the
And we know that, you know, just going to the doctor or a few appointments has an impact on the rest of your life as well, and how it can impact, like, your mood and just keep up with your health and keep you connected with people and being healthy.
So far, I did receive services from the community health, community health services, like Collingwood or Brunswick. This was really very positive change in my life, and it was very positive. Yes,
positive in what kind of way?
For example, the ladies' doctors, they helped me, counselors.
Yeah.
I'm more confident in Australia at the moment because of their support.
Wow. How do you think how they helped you with confidence in being here?
For example, I'm a woman a woman over 45. So there's some services I did receive during and after some women's issues like menopause.
Yeah.
That was excellent, yes.
Yeah.
Feel more relaxed and confident now.
Yeah,
to
beautiful.
Cope with some other issues in my life.
Yeah. I mean, it's really, can be a hard thing to go through, and to have support that felt nice for you must have been really beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. And before we finish today, I just want to give you the space to say whatever you would like about yourself or community health or co-health and what you would want our listeners to know.
We could say that it was excellent services, and definitely people needed these services. If they exclude more services instead of closing down, it would be good for us, but good for refugees, for needed people, that vulnerable people. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing how important community health is for people who are, like, multiply marginalized, and having everything in one spot, low cost, less wasteless, with translators and getting familiar with the system, that you can go every 10 years and have female doctors and feel great. Yeah, we have to save it. And we will put all the information in our show notes about Save Community Health. But thank you so much again for coming on the show.
Thanks for your time.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings. Cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au. You are tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And you just heard an interview that our team member Inez did with Hadisa. Now, that's an alias. And Hadisa is a SAVE Community Health member and was speaking to Inez about the vital role that CoHealth Collingwood in Fitzroy has played in her life for the past 10 years as a refugee from Afghanistan. Hadisa also made a submission to the government-funded review of CoHealth looking at the proposed CoHealth closures. Now, to contact or join SAVE Community Health, you can email savecommunityhealth@gmail.com. And remember to stay tuned for our interview with Sade, who's a doctor and organizer, about the review and rally this Sunday, which will be coming up after this segment. But for now, we are joined by Tom Cooper, who is a public housing resident, organizer, and member of 44 Flats United, for a conversation about the state government's attack on the older person's high-rise public housing towers, concerns about displacement, and the value of community, as well as the importance of fighting back. Now, to keep up to date with 44 Flats United and support their work, you can search 44_FlatsUnited on Instagram. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. Good morning, Brian.
Yes, thanks very much for coming all the way into the studio today. I really appreciate it. Now, to start off with, can you let our listeners know a bit about your own experience in public housing, where you live and why it's important to you?
Well, it's a few years now, and I've found myself homeless and just going from place to place. I was on a waiting list for a long time. I was offered a couple of places that were terrible, and then I was offered studio apartment in 150 Inkerman Street, which is a 12-storey housing tower. And I was absolutely delighted. I just couldn't believe how fortunate I was, and I just was really, really, really grateful to have a solid place that I knew that I could just really breathe out and enjoy.
Yeah, I really love how you've framed it as being a place that you can exhale, right? You know,
yeah.
Not having to hold your breath and move from place to place, to always be in survival mode, but to really rest. Now, you live in one of the older person's high-rise towers,
yep.
And that is dedicated housing, and the majority of people that live there are over the age of 55. And while the state government's plans to redevelop the high-rise towers had been talked about previously as putting the older person's high-rises, of which there are 13, later down the track. At the start of this year, we heard that 7 of those towers were actually going to be redeveloped as part of the third tranche of the program. Can you tell me about how that announcement landed with you and with your neighbours?
Well, it was an incredible shock because I guess I was like a lot of other people that thought, oh, well, this might happen in 10 years or more, and won't be an issue, you know. So I'm 75. And there was a knock on the door one day, and there was someone from Holmes Vic at the door just said, oh, this tower's coming down and you're going to have to move. And I just, my instant reaction was, no, no, it's not on, you know, this is... And there was no evidence, there was no justification. And this was, a lot of people felt really shaken.
Mm. Yeah, and can you talk about the community in the tower and your relationships with other folks? Have you been talking about this? What's that been like?
Yeah, well, it's actually in the process of this from unusually, I suppose, unexpectedly. This has developed a really even closer bond, and it's something that we're really getting to know each other so much more in the quest to see who wants to stay. And it's like a fantastic energy, because there are a number of different communities within there. That there's a big Russian community that have been there for many, many years, and they're really, really strong bonded together, and there's no way they want to move out. And, you know, like, we know the health benefits of a good, strong community, and to just blow them to the winds, it'd be terrible.
Yeah. I mean, I did want to ask as well, you know, about how resisting displacement is also something you need to balance against really demanding the rental protections and the quality of housing that you deserve from Homes Victoria, because, you know, there has been also a long period of these towers being neglected by government or, you know, selectively maintained. Can that's you talk right. about
yeah,
what
well,
that's been
when
like?
When I first went there, it was really tranquil. Just a really, really delightful atmosphere. There's never any fear about this or that. The place just felt really clean, well-maintained. Just and over the years, like with COVID, when people would move out and then there were empty flats and people were living on the streets and whatever they were brought in, and it really changed. And it used to be 55-plus, and then they were... they've gone against that, and there's a whole lot of younger people there, and they need a place for sure, but they also need more than just a key and a bed, you know, to get right, because they've been so traumatised from sleeping rough and blah, blah, blah. So that's affected a big change to the whole ambience.
Yeah, it is a really challenging thing that I've noticed as a housing researcher myself, where the eligibility criteria for people coming into housing has been restricted more and more to people who have the highest level of need, but that support's not being provided. It means that it does tend to put longer standing residents in tension with people that are really doing it tough and need housing, who are being, you know, co-located without adequate supports.
Absolutely.
And I can imagine that that's really a difficult thing to manage.
Well, when you've got a lot of older women, you know, that feel, I don't want to say scared, but as it, they tend to stay, keep to themselves a lot more, and there's a lot of late night noise and action and crashing and anger and what have you that goes on with different things. Care is very important, and it's lacking, you know, and it's a short stop, you know. And the government's not, the department is not maintaining and looking after the building like it used to. It feels, a lot of people suspect that it's a deliberate thing to allow sort of cockroach and bed bug infestations to sort of carry on, and just generally, you know, it's things getting broken and not replaced. I had a meeting a few weeks ago with the recently changed Minister Harriet Ching.
Yeah.
And she said the maintenance would be kept up really well right until the last person left. Well, I said, well, it's not being kept up now, you know? And
Well, I mean, that word care, I think, is really important. And one way that I think about care is the kind of organizing that you've been involved in with 44 Flats. Can you talk about this recent campaign win that you've had and what it's been like to, I guess, get politically engaged with the issue?
Well, it's amazing, because all the conversations that you have, you discover a lot of trauma that people have gone through. Someone coming to the door the other day, just struggling to get to the door, and they've just, you know, passed kidney stones, you know. And they go, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, I'll sign the petition to stay. And, you know, someone else just said, oh, I lost my daughter last week, and so it's a methodical process. You know, you slow down and engage with people, and yeah, you've got a real relationship with people when you find out about what's going on in their lives, and it's about empathy too.
Yeah, and just hearing about the way that people share their reflections on their own experiences and what they're going through and how they link that to the importance of staying where they are, I think is really, really powerful. Now, you mentioned the petition. Can you talk a bit more about that and what you're aiming to achieve?
Yeah, well, basic petition was to state that we want to stay there, that we love public housing and it's really essential, and they should never think about getting rid of public housing. Two, we need security, and we need proper maintenance of the building. Like there's coming and going, you know, with different social issues, like people, you know, wanting to get in and score and stuff like that. And you come to the front door and someone says, oh, let us in. And you say, oh, sorry, I don't know you. And they threaten to stab you. And you get in touch with the department or the police and they don't do anything. But it's what this is normal? I don't think so, you know. And that's for, you know, I'm one of the younger people there. it's an issue, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, in this fight, you've now had over 50%.
We have, and this is what is fantastic, that we've got the majority of people have signed the petition and say definitely we want to stay, but we also want proper security and proper maintenance of the building. And it's wonderful. And this Sunday we're having a bash, a hullabaloo, making a noise to celebrate the fact that we've achieved majority support for the petition, and we're going to have about 7 bands. And
amazing.
We might be shut down after 10 minutes, but it'd be like old St Kilda, you know.
Yeah.
Jackson Street Festival or something.
I mean, it is really worth celebrating these wins, though, because what you're doing is you're leaning into that community that you want to preserve, right? And you're showing people that people care about living there. And, yeah, it is really an excellent achievement, and I appreciate you making the time to speak about it. Is there anything else that you want to add before we wrap up?
Well, I think the old adage, you know, unity is strength. I think it's really, you know, if you had this big Russian community, you know, and this one and that one, let's bring us all together, and appreciating that we might have differences, but our common thing is that we love living there, you know, we really respect having a roof over our heads like that, and each other, you know, in a community room, which is not something that all of the community housing don't offer, even a community room where you can come together, you know. At all times, you know, just thinking public housing, you know, safe public housing, that's what I want to say.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, and solidarity with your fight. Now, listeners, that was Tom Cooper, a public housing resident, organizer, and member of 44 Flats United, who was speaking with us about the state government's attack on older persons' public housing and the fight back. And to support the work of 44 Flats United and keep up to date with their work, you can find 44_FlatsUnited on Instagram. You're tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 7:59 in the morning.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from So Called Australia and beyond. ultimately we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalization intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, we're about
feminisms in their multitudes,
First Nations sovereignty,
land back,
trans liberation, poo-poo on the turfs,
abolition,
anti-racism,
sex worker rights,
staff liberation,
disability justice,
anti-imperialism,
decolonisation,
an end to borders,
workers' justice,
and so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo! Woo!
Hi, I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday, 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is the 23rd of April and it is 8:01 in the morning. And we are now joined by Shade, a doctor and organizer, who has come back on the show to discuss Save CoHealth updates, as well as an upcoming rally demanding the urgent release of findings of the government-funded review of CoHealth, which is happening this Sunday, the 26th of April at 12 p.m. at CoHealth Collingwood. Now, Shade is a doctor who spent 8 years working in Victorian public hospitals and now works in a Melbourne community health centre and remains a dedicated activist involved in the campaign against the closure of CoHealth. This interview follows our chat earlier with Hadisa and also last week's interview with Nicole Bartholomeus, who is the chief executive of CoHealth. And you can follow and join their campaign via Instagram by heading to Instagram and searching Socialists in Healthcare. Good morning, Shade.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. Now, last time we had you on the show, the federal government funded or provided some emergency funding to keep GP services open at CoHealth, Collingwood, Fitzroy and Kensington. And this is going to expire on the 31st of July 2026. Now, with a range of changes having already happened and general counselling having ceased at all sites, what do we know about the future of CoHealth and how has that funding provision supported services? What have you noticed?
Yeah, so it's pretty dire. The counselling, as you mentioned, have closed. The pharmacy at CoHealth Collingwood has also closed, which was pretty tragic for the people there, particularly people on the methadone and addiction support programs, where that was one of the few sort of models of a really integrated addiction service. The CoHealth board have made clear that sort of without additional funding, they will still be closing on July 31st. So that's a pretty imminent deadline for the over 12,000 people that depend on those services. And I think it's important to talk about the sort of death by attrition that has been happening because Labor haven't come out and made clear that they will be funding these services long term. They haven't made clear that sort of regardless of the outcome of the review, they're committed to community health and sort of supporting these centres. There's been this huge death by attrition. So staff members are still looking for other work. Many of them have left. And so it is, you know, a pretty, you know, dangerous and unsafe situation for both staff members and patients at the moment.
Yeah, and I mean, it is just very worrying that we're seeing this process continue to roll on and have a lack of clarity, even though there has been, I believe, a review mm-hmm. of CoHealth. And we did have the chief executive of CoHealth on our program last week, but she didn't comment on the status of this independent review. Can you tell us why the review is important and why it's not yet been released, given yeah. that patients and public were told it was going to be released in March?
Yeah, totally. And so the review, essentially, the Labor Party made clear that additional funding would have to be contingent on and investigating into the financial structuring and the financial management of these clinics and of CoHealth more broadly. And so I think certainly from community health, it's clear that even well-managed centres are massively underfunded. So our position has always been that these services should be funded and kept open regardless of the outcome of the review. But it is important. There is a lot of anger directed towards, you know, the board sort of allowing this to happen and having the power to be able basically withhold primary care from over 12,000 people. I think we know for a fact that CoHealth have been given the findings of the review, that the review has been finalised. And I think it's a really big indictment on both the board and Labor that this has not been made public. It's pretty undemocratic for negotiations to still be going on behind closed doors, and neither of them providing any sort of assurance to patients and staff that the services that their lives depend on, you know, are going to be kept open beyond a few months from now. So, certainly I think we know that the review has been finalised. It should absolutely be made public. And, you know, if there is, you know, accounts to be had sort of within CoHealth, that should absolutely happen. But the ongoing provision of these services should not be contingent on that. The state Labor government has the power to reclaim ownership of these clinics. They also have the power to elect ongoing witnesses to the board as well. And so I think if there are sort of more systemic issues going on at CoHealth, and if the review has exposed that, then absolutely the centre should be made more democratic, and the state Labor government has the power to do that. That should not be used as a threat to withhold funding, though.
Yeah, and we've just actually had a change in the Victorian Cabinet Ministry. We've had another reshuffle, and former Minister for Housing, Harriet Tsing, is now the Minister for Health. Have you heard anything from her on this?
No. Short answer. And so I think that's sort of one of the reasons why we're calling for this rally on Sunday, is really stepping back up the public pressure and sort of refocusing attention on CoHealth. I think there was a lot of optimism with that emergency funding that was released, and so people were pretty best faith about the review, sort of understanding that, you know, of course there has to be sort of an open, transparent, accountable process for ongoing funding that patients has well and truly worn out, particularly given, you know, significant restructuring. I mean, they've just announced a massive slashing of NDIS, and so I think the anger and frustration at being kept out of the process and sort of the fear about the imminent loss of services has really ramped back up the energy. This rally on Sunday is going to be really important in putting attention back on this, you know, pretty significant issue.
Yeah, well, can you tell us about that rally? Mm-hmm. It's coming up on Sunday, the 26th of April at 12 p.m. at Collingwood CoHealth, mm-hmm. 365 Hoddle Street. What are your demands?
So the primary one is the release of the review process and the review findings. I think, like we said, the demand of the campaign the whole time has been that these services should be funding and the Labor should be funded, and the Labor Party should publicly make clear that the services will be kept open regardless of restructuring and accountability and all of the sort of things that were in the terms of reference of the review. It's extremely undemocratic for that to be withheld from the public, and so we absolutely think that the review findings should be released. But parallel to that, the demand is that these services stay open with no further loss to any of their services, regardless of the outcome of the review.
Yeah. Now, just one last question, and I wanted to bring it back to that, you know, broader structural issue. You mentioned the NDIS cuts, and in our previous interview where we had you on, you were talking about, you know, this rollback of preventative care and of ongoing public health provision that, you know, funnels people towards acute care pathways, which then creates a bottleneck and people's health conditions worsening because they're not able to access, you know, primary preventative health care. You know, as we look at this sort of landscape coming up to the May budget, what are some things folks should be keeping an eye out for and calling for when it comes to actual funding of accessible health care for all, which, you know, the Minister Mark Butler has said has been a primary human right that Australia is very proud of fulfilling.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, Medicare is the big one. GP services should be funded. I mean, I think the, you know, hospitals also have funding problems. And, you know, absolutely we should be rallying for increase in health funding across the board. But it's pretty appalling that the most cost-effective part of the healthcare system is the one that it's the most privatised at the moment. And certainly will continue to be, you know, privatised, looking at what they've just done to the NDIS. So it's those community-based preventative primary care services that keep people out of expensive hospitals, outside of, you know, the cath labs when they have heart attacks, that are being, you know, slashed and burned. And so I think, you know, re-diverting that focus to, you know, primary preventative care, it's not a coincidence that those are all the ones that get federal funding and not state funding. And so I think, yeah, certainly looking, you know, bigger picture, it's, you know, really important that we demand the federal government to invest in that sort of, you know, holistic primary preventative healthcare service.
Yeah, thank you so much, Sade. I really appreciate you coming in. And a reminder again that the rally that is happening this Sunday, 26th April at 12 p.m. at CoHealth Collingwood, 365 Hoddle Street, will be calling for the urgent release of findings of the government-funded review of CoHealth and just some transparency, democratic, you know, communication with people and some certainty around the vital provision of these healthcare services. Thank you, Sade.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And that was Sade, doctor and organizer, who joined us again to discuss updates from the Save CoHealth campaign.
3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
Don't have $1 million and still want to have a good education for your kid? Tune into the Dogs program. We are the defenders of government schools. 12 p.m. on Saturdays here on 3CR 855 and AM dial podcast, streaming live on 3cr.org.au and 3CR digital. We defend government schools because they need it.
I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday, 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
Justice, diversity, community, politics, sport.
Join us every Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m.
No. We now start at 3:30 for an hour.
For the Sporting Record.
Or check out the Sporting Record podcasts available on Spotify, Apple, 3cr.org, wherever.
Baseball,
Common Social Change Library is an online collection of educational resources for those involved in community campaigns and social and labour movements. It collects, curates, and distributes key lessons and resources from progressive movements from around Australia and across the globe. The library includes over 1,400 resources covering campaign strategy, community organising, activist history, digital campaigning, justice, equity, diversity and inclusion, and much, much more. It's free to access the library, so check out the collection at www.commonslibrary.org.
Has Centrelink made a decision you disagree with? Most Centrelink decisions can be appealed up to 3 times. Examples of decisions you can appeal include whether you're eligible for a payment, cancellation or suspension of your payment, how much you get paid, and Centrelink debts. One of the most common Centrelink decisions appealed are Centrelink debts. Centrelink will say you owe a debt if the staff determine you've been paid more than you should have. Debts can occur for a variety of reasons. In some instances, if there's been an administrative error or if you have special circumstances, you may not have to repay that debt. The appeal process is free, but time limits can apply and will affect your entitlement to back payment. Social Security Rights Victoria is a specialist community legal centre providing Victorians free advice to help you understand your Centrelink issues and the appeal processes. You can contact Social Security Rights Victoria on 9481 0355 or online at ssrv.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 8:16 in the morning and we are now heading into our final interview for today, where we are joined by disability advocate Andrew Bretherton to unpack this week's announcements about the Albanese government's planned cuts to the NDIS in the May budget, as well as some of the relationships between austerity, disability and inadequate recognition for people with ME/CFS. Andrew is an advocate for disability rights and culture and is the convener for Accessible Victorian Greens. Good morning, Andrew.
Oh, good morning, Priya.
Thanks very much for making the time to come on today's show. Now, I wanted to begin by asking about the process of accessing the NDIS as a person with ME/CFS. How have eligibility requirements changed over time? And what's that been like to access those kinds of funded supports?
Well, for me, it was very hard to actually even get a scheme. I had to spend like about $20,000 on a lawyer to be able to help me be eligible for the scheme. Because unfortunately, if you have ME/CFS, the criteria was a bit skewed towards rejection rather than offering help. And I run a Facebook group called Call for Change, and we actually found out through Freedom of Information requests that the NDIS had spent about $100,000 on consulting a quite controversial figure in the ME/CFS world to help them with rejecting patients with ME/CFS from being eligible for the scheme. So it was quite the uphill battle.
Yeah, that is extremely concerning to hear, and a massive amount of resources that you've had to personally put into accessing these funded supports through the NDIS. And you know, I'm wondering why you think there is this process for folks with ME/CFS and, this high level of rejection rates.
I think it's due to the government's own bias. I think they see it as a cost-cutting measure to exclude patients with chronic illnesses like myself and have them end up through the hospital system, which usually means going through a lot of kind of abusive practices that patients have self-reported as making them worse. So the government thinks that they're saving money by rejecting all these people, but in fact it actually costs them more to do so through these patients than having to go through the hospital system or through Medicare system. And end up in, you know, pretty poor outcomes.
Of course, you know, it is kicking the can down the road, so to speak, and waiting for people to experience more acute, you know, presentation of chronic health concerns, you know, being exposed to being further, you know, having your health further worn away in order to access different kinds of supports when actually, you know, the recognition appropriately of ME/CFS as a serious ongoing health condition that is disabling is what is, you know, what appears to be the barrier here. And does this sort of affect access to other kinds of disability support resourcing for people with ME/CFS outside of the NDIS?
Well, this is what I'm really scared about with yesterday's announcements is what are foundational supports for someone with ME/CFS? Because my experience before getting on the NDIS, which has had incredible outcomes for me, and I'm able to actually leave the house now and participate in society and in the community, my experience and what I'm scared that Labor is going to force me to do with these foundational supports is send me back to those abusive programs that I was forced into. And for me, because they were not following the biomedical research, it had ended up in me becoming further disabled. So when I was first diagnosed, I could still work. But after I had done one of these fatigue clinic programs through the medical system, I was disabled to the point where I was pretty much housebound and almost bedbound in my home with no supports. So I'm terrified Labor's foundational supports will again rely on these kind of vested interests, such as the New South Wales Fatigue Clinic, who they paid all that money to reject us from the scheme. And put us through those kind of systems again.
Yeah, it is, you know, something that I've noticed in terms of the way that the NDIS frames chronic illness is that there's still, you know, some assumed orientation towards recovery that is imposed upon people rather than recognition that of the chronicness of chronic illness. Now, the federal government has identified the NDIS as a primary target to curb government expenditure in this year's budget, as you mentioned. And I was hoping that you could explain the charges of a cost blowout that government's talked about and plans to limit the growth of the scheme, which I think can sound pretty technical, but has real effects on people accessing it.
Yeah, well, is it a cost blowout? Because it's not really a cost blowout in the way that it's being described. Like, the NDIS supports a relatively small population of, I think, 4.3 million Australians that actually have a disability. And this scheme was created because people that need these supports to function have to be able to participate in society. So framing disabled people as a budget problem is a political choice by Labor, and this just kind of shows that it's not about priorities. It is about just what their priorities are, and it's this kind of return to this medical model of disability and a return to institutionalization just in the... You know, it's been framed as this cost-saving measure. But, you know, if we looked at aged care when that was first introduced, you could make the same arguments that are being made now about the NDIS. But we would never say, oh, no, we don't need aged care. It's this kind of ableist thinking of, oh, well, it will never happen to me. I'll never end up with a disability. But for me, I never thought I would end up with ME/CFS. And thank God the NDIS was there to help and support me. But yeah, it's a very concerning, stripping away every Australian's rights, which is if you do become disabled, the government will look after you. But now this model, which is based more on a medical model or more geared towards visible disabilities, they're going to determine who is disabled enough to and worthy enough to receive support. And it's not really clear the kind of framing that they will use to determine that.
Yeah, and I mean, in Mark Butler's speech yesterday, there seemed to be this almost perverse pitting of aged care against disability. And I'm wondering just, you know, as we wrap up, what are some of the impacts you foresee coming from the cuts that were announced by Federal Health Minister Mark Butler yesterday to have on the quality of life of people accessing or seeking access to NDIS-funded supports?
Well, I believe just like the robo-debt debacle, this will end up in deaths, neglect, and poor economic outcomes, not just for the participants, but for Australia in general. And I think it was very telling that he didn't talk about the economic impacts of removing this money from the economy, because it's going to affect jobs in the sector, obviously, and it's also going to affect small businesses within the sector as well. And we know from like the Thatcher period and all of that, austerity measures don't really work and they don't really help the economy. And if they were serious about tackling fraud, as they say they are, they would put in measures that actually tackle fraud. But the measures they've put in to yesterday has... it's just more about removing participants from the scheme and removing supports to participants from the scheme. It's not really going to touch fraud at all. And, you know, they want to make everyone a registered provider, but for years the community has been saying, well, it's actually the registered providers that are doing most of the fraud and abuse. So it's just keeping that money within a certain section of people, and it's not going to be distributed throughout the economy. The NDIS makes, I think, more than $2 per dollar spent that gets circulated through the economy, and it looks like Labor wants to withdraw that money and send it overseas to fund wars or corporate donations for their subsidies and lobby mates that want the money instead. And wealth inequality is really what's driving this. And the choice is, do we invest back into our people or do we listen to what corporate Australia wants to say and see the continual erosion of social services such as the NDIS and aged care, which has also received similar cuts?
Yeah. I mean, it really is... you know, it's a political choice, it's a moral and an ethical choice, and I really hope that people keep an eye on what disability advocates and organisations are saying in the wake of this week's announcement. Look, thank you, Andrew, so much for your time today. I really, really appreciate it.
Okay, no worries. Thank you.
And that was disability advocate Andrew Bretherton, who joined us to unpack this week's announcements about the Albanese government's planned cuts to the NDIS in the May budget, as well as the relationships between austerity, disability, and inadequate recognition for people with ME/CFS. Earlier in the show, we heard some excerpts from the Wednesday, 8th April edition of 3CR's Raising Our Voices program. We heard from Hadissa, who's a member of the Safe Community Health Coalition. We heard from Tom Cooper, a public housing resident organizer and member of 44 Flats United. And we were joined by Sade, a doctor and organizer who's also involved in the Socialists in Healthcare campaign to save CoHealth. And there is an upcoming rally this Sunday, the 26th of April at 12 p.m. at CoHealth Collingwood, 365 Hoddle Street in Collingwood, demanding the urgent release of findings of a government-funded review of the CoHealth institution model system. Very important conversations all around this week, a lot of focus on public health, on government spending, and really on the fact that these allocations of resources are political choices. Stay tuned, and we will be back to you next week.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find NIBS opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall, Carlton. Keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.